Hello and welcome again in the studio. I'm Redbeard with the stories behind history's greatest rock and roll album. Today, in the studio, it's the May 2005 Cream reunion that took a mere 36 years to arrange.
In the sunshine of your love.
The 5 or 6 or maybe 10 years after the demise of Cream, there was no value attached to this because not enough time had gone by. But then you add another 5 years, maybe 20 years to that, and people start to miss it. They actually miss that because it's to them it's gone, certainly kind of part of a dead age. And yet these people are still around, and yet I'm still around, and yet McCartney's still around, and yet Mick and Keith are still around. So as much as people, in respect of being an audience, want to know what's going on, they're starting to realize that, you know, that they miss this period, you know, that they miss the fact that there was so much spontaneity then. And yet their heroes are still around, so it's possible to stay in touch with it.
In a white room with black curtains, never stage time.
I'm Eric Clapton with Redbeard.
Welcome back in the studio with Cream. I'm Jack Bruce with Redbeard.
A reunion of Cream. Now there's something you'd never catch me saying. Why bother with such flights of fancy? It was preposterous, the mere thought, like those urban legends going around. Yes, Cream was the English trio of vocalist, bass player, songwriter Jack Bruce, avant-garde drummer Ginger Baker, and blues rock guitarist and vocalist Eric Clapton, who recorded 4 studio albums, 2 of which, 1967's Disraeli Gears and 1968's Wheels of Fire, are on everybody's Essential 100 list of all-time albums. But realize these 2 astounding facts on the timeline. For all of Cream's impact on rock history, it all occurred in barely a 2.5-year period. And with the exception of a one-off performance at the 1993 Hall of Fame induction, a Cream reunion was something that Jack Bruce wanted for some time. Ginger Baker, on the other hand, had no interest in it. Bruce and Baker had a falling out, with Ginger admitting as much in the South African press. That left Eric Clapton as the swing vote. But Clapton's career had been stellar since the demise of Cream, so he certainly didn't need it. According to Eric in the interview segment on the Cream Royal Albert Hall May 2005 DVD disc, it seems that the mere fact that BBC, that is Baker, Bruce, and Clapton, the fact that they're still able and willing to reunite and play with passion had as much to do with it as anything. Eric Clapton has a theory about not only whether artists can create into their 60s, Picasso and Les Paul were just getting warmed up at 60, but just as importantly, whether the rock and roll audience will still care. Here's Cream's Eric Clapton with me in the studio.
It's that old thing, I think, comes back to that one thing, you don't miss your water till the wells run dry. And that, you know, while the people that are making these songs are contemporaries, it's not necessarily that much value attached to it. I mean, around this, you know, like the 5 or 6 or maybe 10 years after the demise of Cream, there was no value attached to this because not enough time had gone by. But then you add another 5 years, maybe 20 years to that, and people start to miss it. They actually miss that because it's to them it's gone, certainly kind of part of a dead age. And yet these people are still around, and yet I'm still around, and yet McCartney's still around, and yet Mick and Keith are still around. So as much as people, in respect of being an audience, want to know what's going on, they're starting to realize that, you know, that they miss this period, you know, that they miss the fact that there was so much spontaneity then. And yet their heroes are still around, so it's possible to stay in touch with it.
Yeah. I think the garden variety rock and roll fan realized that, though, before the creators of these things did.
Probably so.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I have extreme faith in the listening abilities of the audience and the awareness of the audience. much more than I probably ever gave credit to. And I think it's that the problem comes. I mean, we're luckier. Musicians are luckier than most other creators. We're much luckier than actors. We're much luckier than writers.
In what way?
Well, because those people work in such cut off
isolated
circumstances, like especially film actors who are in a studio. They don't even know what the audience thinks of their work, really. They have to live on, you know, a kind of second hand information. And writers too, and painters don't really know. An artist on the stage, a musician on the stage, has almost a direct line of communication.
Like live theater.
Exactly.
You know whether you're bombing or
you know whether you're bombing or not, and you know what's working and what they want on the night. And we're very lucky to have that. We're very lucky to have that. And I think that's one reason why I insist on touring all the time, is because I don't want to grow old, and I don't want to live in the past. You know, I don't want to become bitter and critical and cynical because I think all my best work was done years ago. I want to keep offering things and see how they go.
That's Cream with the Jack Bruce Pete Brown classic White Room, with Bruce and Eric Clapton alternating vocal lines seamlessly. Bass player Jack Bruce and drummer Ginger Baker were avant-garde jazzers, not Teddy Boy rockers like the early Beatles or Motown mods like The Who. Jack Bruce remembers seeing Ginger Baker's drum kit for the very first time.
Well, it's very unusual. I mean, even more so then than it is now in a way, because he was playing jazz drums and he had his cymbals. Normally cymbals are kind of like an angle of 45 degrees or something. His cymbals were like straight up. I'd never seen that before. And his drums were all very flat. And he was playing some drums he had made himself, which I thought, well, I didn't know that at the time, but they looked different from most drums and they sounded great. I mean, mostly it was, I think it was the energy and the volume that impressed me, you know, a lot of energy, a lot of presence, you know. I was very impressed, I must say. I think it was very impressive.
Jack Bruce was not, however, similarly impressed with young guitarist Eric Clapton before Cream was formed.
To be honest, we were working so hard, I wasn't really aware of anything outside of the work I was doing and getting married and things like that, you know. But I'd vaguely heard of Eric, but Ginger knew more about him. But Eric used to come down to our shows a lot. He liked the band that I was in, and we played a little bit. We had a little jam with the Yardbirds one time, and that was the first time I played with him. He was obviously a good player. You could tell that right away, but I didn't think, oh, I must play with this guy or anything.
Eric Clapton had bailed out of the Yardbirds just as they had started to gain popularity. Here's Eric Clapton with me in the studio.
Never really counted myself as a pop musician to begin with. It was something that slipped into my life time and again, you know, that you know, I would toy with it. But it never really was a serious option to me. I mean, making music has always been a series of changes and explorations for me that have nothing to do with trend. Nothing to do with saleability, really. It's really me discovering me.
I mean, you were scared about being a pop star
with the Yardbirds.
When you left the Yardbirds?
Yeah, I ran like hell. I ran the opposite direction as fast as I could go. It scared the living daylights out of me. I could see, nightmares. No, I still do. I mean, as we talk. You know, as grown-ups, thank God, we're sitting here talking like we're having a conversation. But the idea of doing an alternative thing to this, but going on TV and... I mean, for me, the nightmare is doing a chat show, you know, Because everyone knows you're there to sell your product. Everyone knows you've got to be entertaining. You're really in another world. And I
make sure you don't put your hand over the cover of the album or the book, right?
Yeah.
Make sure you don't block the cover.
All of that. It's scary.
Thinking about the times you drove in my car, thinking that I might have drove it too far. And I'm thinking about the love you laid on my table. Told you not to wander. The swans that they live in the fall. Then I told you about our kid, he's married to Mabel.
Thank you. talking about a girl that looks quite like you. She'd be the had the time to wait in the queue.
On the DVD to the May 2005 Royal Albert Hall London shows, Cream drummer Ginger Baker makes the surprising revelation that, seeing as the studio version of Badge appears on the final Cream album, 1969's Goodbye, this is the first time that Cream has performed Badge live. The song's title is a famous misnomer. The late George Harrison wrote and recorded the song's bridge and scrawled the term bridge on the recording tape box before heading back to rejoin the Beatles. When the members of Cream added Harrison's guitar break to the song, they thought he had named the song Badge as well. Up next, Eric Clapton feels that his fellow Cream mates, quote, have a healthy disregard for audience requirements, end quote. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for the double CD and double DVD, Cream, Royal Albert Hall, London, May 2005.
Welcome back in the studio with Cream. I'm Jack Bruce with Redbeard.
In the studio for the double CD and double DVD of Cream's reunion at the Royal Albert Hall in London. And John Mellencamp once told me on an edition of In the Studio that, quote, your reasons for getting in this business are not the same reasons you stay in this business. Eric Clapton contends that it's those initial reasons, then, that help determine your career longevity.
It depends, really, your reasons for getting into this in the first place have a lot to do with it. I think a lot of people who came into it as pop musicians didn't expect to be working in this business after the age of 35. They didn't expect to, and for them to be enjoying, you know, a sort of second wind is quite a surprise to them, because it's, you know, they really didn't set out to make it a life's work. I don't think they thought of it in the long term. I did, because
honestly,
I thought that I'm doing this forever, because my heroes were all old men anyway. You know, by the time I got around to ever meeting them, there were old men who were still practicing their craft, and that to me was the ideal. I didn't ever think of it as something I would do until I was 25 and then quit. But a lot of people did. A lot of people branched out, became businessmen in the publishing world, or became, you know, producers, or became, you know, executives in the business, staying in touch, but not necessarily playing. Well, I mean, no, there are not bad. I'm not going to say these are bad reasons. No, I mean, just to have fun would be a good enough reason.
And get paid for it.
To have fun and get paid for it and get laid and
like
travel and all these things.
Sounds like a great job to me.
Very appealing, and not take it too seriously. See? Not take it too seriously. And then when the popularity starts to wane, you find a sort of a secure way of getting a real job.
Proper job.
Dying about it. Hey.
love, darling, is good enough for me. Even like it, darling, everything's a lie about me. People are crying.
Featuring Jack Bruce on vocal and Eric Clapton on guitar on Willie Dixon's Spoonful, a staple in their original shows. After Cream's debut album, Fresh Cream, was a less than robust seller, They met up with U.S. musician Felix Pappalardi and producer Tom Dowd, who had considerable success cutting soul and R&B hits on New York City-based Atlantic Records, Cream's U.S. label. Here's Jack Bruce.
Well, that was a funny situation. We'd already done our first record, which is called Fresh Cream, and it hadn't really done very well, to be honest. It hadn't got any attention. Certainly in the States, it wasn't happening. But we got a deal with Atlantic Records. We went to Atlantic Studio in New York to cut an album, and Felix happened to be there. I think Ahmet Ertegun said, you better do something with these guys. And Felix turned out, I mean, he was very useful because he, in a very subtle way, he got things out of us. It wasn't the kind of producer who says, you do this and you do that, which would have been impossible with us. We wouldn't have listened. But first of all, he got us in the same room at the same time. And him and Tommy Dowd had... they were pretty open because we had these ideas that were very far, very ahead of their time, really. I mean, Tommy Dowd was used to recording people like Otis Redding, Aretha Franklin, very great people, but in a very definite form, you know, way of playing. The amplifiers would be in the studio, the same amplifiers for the bass player, the guitar player, all the time, you know, with a key that you unlocked, you know. That was the way they did it in those days. And so we came along and we just set up our huge Marshall stacks in the studio and played loud. And kind of they were a bit shocked, I think. This had not been done before.
Writing on allmusic.com, Stephen Thomas Erlewine's review of the Cream Reunion CD notes that, and I quote, "The chemistry among guitarist-vocalist Eric Clapton, bassist-vocalist Jack Bruce, and drummer Ginger Baker is still palpable," end quote. But truth be told, when Cream first arrived in America, Atlantic Records president Ahmet Ertegun wanted to change that chemistry, the chemistry that would go on to make the now classic Disraeli Gears album, according to Jack Bruce.
We came to America to make this record, which eventually became Disraeli Gears. We had done some... not demos exactly. Yeah, I guess you would call them demos. But rehearsals, really, of the material that was going to become this album. As usual, I had come with like 20 songs, and Eric had 2 songs, and Ginger had 0.5 of a song. And so we did this rehearsal, and we tried a lot of stuff, including things like Sunshine of Your Love and White Room and all those songs which were to go on to become classics. But when we got to the States to record them, Ahmet Ertegun and all of the big wheels at Atlantic said, no, that's not happening, it's not good, it's not commercial, it won't sell, people won't like it, it's rubbish, psychedelic hogwash, I think somebody said. And they also said to me, well, and anyway, you're not the front man, you can't sing, Eric's got to be the front man. So what have you got, Eric? And Eric said, nothing. So what they did have was, what we had recorded so far was the backing track for a blues called Hey Lottie Mama. They took that away, and Felix Pappalardi and his wife wrote Strange Brew on top of that. You know, that's how that song came about. But then that's all they had. They had this one song. So they had to use my songs. But we didn't want to.
1967 was indeed a revolutionary time in music, art, film, literature, politics, civil rights. For example, there's Cream's second album, its cover featuring Dayglo Art, the curious title, containing the surname of a former British Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli. Here's Jack Bruce with the inside joke.
What happened was that for the first time ever, a Scotsman had won the Tour de France, which is... really something. We were very proud of this guy. He's called Tommy Simpson. And he won this great cycle race, which had always been dominated by French or Italians. He won it. And then the next year he was doing it, he died on his bike. he was taking speed. He was taking amphetamines and to help him up the Alps. And I guess he took too much and his heart literally burst on the hill. And it was, you know, we were completely... very saddened by this, and we were just talking about it, and there's some cycle gears called derailleur gears the roadie said, yeah, well, maybe he was using them Disraeli gears. It was like that in those days, you know. We were all crazy.
Robert Johnson Delta Blues Standard, always a showstopper for them originally, still a highlight, but given a more authentic interpretation by pulling the tempo down a notch from their earlier version, but not the intensity.
Come on, Eric Clapton! Eric Clapton on the guitar vocals.
Up next, a rock veteran contends that, and I quote, Cream was a little-known band from England that was a lot less known than The Who. Sound like an uninformed opinion? Well, here's a hint. His initials are EC. I'm Redbeard in the studio for the Cream double CD and DVD, Royal Albert Hall, May 2005.
I'm Eric Clapton with Redbeard.
Welcome back in the studio for Cream's reunion CD and DVD at London's Royal Albert Hall, May 2005. As the pilgrimage I and tens of thousands of others are making this very week to New York City will attest, Cream captured something in our hearts long ago with the power trio format. Here's Jack Bruce with me in the studio.
I mean, I always liked trios in the jazz situation before. I always liked people like Ornette Coleman, who played these pianoless quartets, which are trios. I always liked that because it's a bareness, it's a spare quality that I like, which it probably is like, I mean, if you're listening to somebody like Robert Johnson, it's just a guitar and a voice. But everything's there, the rhythm, the harmony, the melody, everything's covered. You don't necessarily need a 10-piece band to cover that. One person can do it, you know. And I like the idea of a trio. We did toy with the idea for a while of having Steve Winwood in the band, but we decided to kind of be brave about it and just try and do it as a trio because it was different. It was also exciting. The idea of just the three of us having to go out there is a kind of, it's a nice feeling, and we liked it.
Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker were avant-garde jazzers, but Jack Bruce contends that the Turkish immigrant Erdogan brothers, who owned Atlantic Records, resisted his original songs for Cream, even though they were jazz and R&B aficionados themselves.
I think there was a lot of struggle at the time within the band. Eric was very ambitious. And he was trying to promote himself a bit. And for whatever reasons, they weren't too crazy about the material. I think it also was, they thought it was too ahead of its time. I mean, White Room starts off in 5-4, which is unusual. That's a funny time for a rock and roll song to start with. They couldn't really hear the Sunshine of Your Love, which I really knew was a smash hit song. They couldn't hear it. But I remember Booker T came by one day when we were just playing that, and he said, that's a great thing. So they began to think, well, if Booker T likes it, maybe something there. So we recorded it, and Sunshine became Atlantic's biggest all-time selling single.
It turns out that Sunshine of Your Love had to be reintroduced to Eric Clapton just a few years ago.
It took a whole other series of events to bring that song back to my attention, because when I was with Cream, I was very young, and I wasn't particularly taking much notice of what was going on, to be honest with you. I was in my own little world, and just a guitar player with a rock band. The time that we existed and were working and touring, we didn't have all this mania that exists now for the 60s. Cream was really just a little known band from England, sort of slightly less... Well, in fact, a lot less known than The Who. And we weren't really aware of what we were. I mean, and I especially wasn't particularly aware of how good the songwriting was. I just was all these songs were just vehicles for me to play riffs in and play solos. And when the Cream broke up and time went by, that all, you know, was another, just to me, gone. You know, gone stuff, gone in the past. And it wasn't until I did the Letterman Show as guest of Paul Schaefer's band that the peculiarity and the niceties of that song were reintroduced to me when he said, "Look, let's do that for fun." And I heard it as if I was a complete observer, you know, very objectively listened to them play and then joined in and found that it was a great song. And I actually had to learn the words. I mean, you can believe that. I'd played that song with Cream for a year and a half, 2 years, and didn't even know what the words were. You see? So that was... that was the reason for that. And I hope as time goes by, other things will come up like that, you know, because it's not always good to play songs which you have your own series of reasons to play. It's actually nice to get inside someone else's skin and see what they like about it, you know, see what they like about it. So you can look at it afresh, really.
with Jack Bruce and Eric Clapton trading vocal lines and Ginger Baker playing a Native American drum pattern suggested by the late producer Tom Dowd. That one brought the relatively reserved Albert Hall audience to its feet throughout. I'm Redbeard.